Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck. I appreciate all of you joining us on this weekend. I also appreciate everybody who tuned in during the week to our website and podcast. That is kereport.com. It was another busy week of daily editorials and a lot of company updates and company introductions. On this weekend show, I am kicking the show off with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. You can also follow Mike on Twitter at RealMikeLarson. Mike, let's start off with U.S. equity markets, because as maybe boring as we could say the markets are right now, they're boring to the upside, at least for this last about 2 week period. The markets have just continued to grind higher. So outside of the NASDAQ, which actually the big tech stocks have actually bounced back fairly strong, we have the S&P and the Dow at all-time highs. And again, it's in this almost boring, grinding nature higher that reminds me of, I think it was 2017, where just every day the markets slowly crept higher. Now, again, this has only happened over the last 2 weeks, but Mike, how are you viewing the U.S. markets in terms of strength, overall strength right now?
Sure, and you're absolutely right about kind of the grinding nature of this advance, and I think it really owes itself to a couple of big drivers that aren't changing. And when drivers aren't changing and there's no expectation they're going to change, generally speaking, Wall Street's not going to change its positioning. We have, first of all, a Federal Reserve that, regardless of what the economic data is showing, which is a clear economic improvement on a lot of fronts, and a pickup in inflationary pressures, the Fed continues to say, and Jay Powell is going to go on 60 Minutes on Monday now and talk about it probably, that, you know, despite what the economy is doing, we're still going to keep interest rates low. We plan to do so well into at least 2022 and probably 2023, which, again, is different from past, economic shifts in the history of this country the last 30 some odd years. Even in the last cycle, the Fed was ultimately forced to start moving the whole taper tantrum issue. This time, they want to push things out even further, despite some fairly strong rebound news and despite vaccination news, which continues to improve in terms of the number of people being vaccinated, which, of course, speeds the reopening process. So you've got that going on. Then when it comes to fiscal policy, you know, you move monetary to fiscal policy. I mean, if you look at what the Biden administration is doing, this is like, you know, some combination or some reincarnation of the New Deal or the Great Society programs that Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson pushed through in their eras. It's sort in terms of goals, breadth, cost, social impact, economic impact. Biden is very much trying to be that type of president or trying to push through that type of agenda. Now, again, whether you agree politically with it or not, and that's up to listeners to decide. The important thing from a market standpoint is that there's a money flood coming out of Washington. There is going to, Biden probably won't get absolutely everything he wants. There's going to be some horse trading in Congress as this $2 trillion infrastructure bill goes through the rigmarole. And as the other $1 to $2 trillion social infrastructure, social policy type program comes up next. But you're still talking about trillions and trillions of dollars on the heels of the $1.9 trillion stimulus that just passed a few months ago, or several weeks ago. So again, you add it all together, you've got monetary policy that's the easiest it's ever been relative to what the economic data is showing. You've got fiscal policy, which is flooding the system with money. So it's no surprise that Wall Street is going along for the ride. And that, frankly, as an investor, that's what you want to do too.
Yeah, exactly, right? It's all about playing that continued trend, and that trend just continues to be higher. But Mike, what could possibly throw this off? Because everything that you're saying right now about kind of the vaccination rate and the general reopening and even some of the economic data getting better in the U.S. specifically and all these easy money policies, which just seem like they're not going anywhere, what could throw this whole narrative off?
Sure. You've got a couple of things that would be probably my most identifiable catalyst. The first would be if the interest rate market gets unruly. I mean, what we had already is a decent increase in interest rates, but it was still generally the same type of activity we saw in the stock market. It was generally plodding. There was a period of time, a week or two, where interest rates started to get jumpy and the market reacted, but that's all settled down again. So you would need to see the bond market really getting fearful of a complete overdoing of this process and a reversal in the 40 some odd year trend of, you know, declining inflation, disinflation, or methflation, as I call it sometimes, and a 70 style or a real type sharp type move in interest rates. So that's probably your primary catalyst. Secondary would be if there's a significant shift in the political wind. If Biden loses, he can't buy off or placate a few of the Democrats that are more conservative on the spectrum with a few things to try and get their votes and cement their votes on this infrastructure program. If something truly gets derailed there, that would be a noteworthy development. So I think those are two of the primary catalysts. Other than that, let's be honest. What is this type of backdrop fueling? It's fueling a lot of ridiculous over-the-top speculation. I mean, you just saw the sort of mini boom and bust on the SPAC and all these SPACs and, no revenue, no earnings, no operations, companies coming public at a record rate. You just had this hedge fund guy, blow himself up to the tune of, $20, $30 billion in a couple of days by taking outsized derivatives market positions in large stocks. Funded by Wall Street banks that then turned around and lost billions of dollars themselves. I mean, this isn't the kind of stuff you see in sort of a normal market environment. So those kind of, a speculative blow-off combination, leverage type, too much leverage causing one of these long-term capital management type things out of left field, that would probably be my third thing to point to. The problem is that kind of stuff is unknowable or untimable until it starts to happen. But you do want to watch market indicators, things like credit spreads and so on, to see if, there's some rumblings going on out there. So far, we haven't seen it.
Yeah, Mike, how interesting is it that the hedge fund blow up really didn't have a bigger impact on the markets? Somehow the markets and the big institutions that also had to take pretty significant write-offs, they have, for the most part, been able to weather that storm. So obviously, more massive hedge fund blow ups would hurt their books and, I think hurt the markets a bit more. But don't we need to take into account that the market somehow did digest pretty easily that massive hedge fund blow up?
Sure, you're right. I mean, if you weren't in a handful of these stocks that this one family office fund was impacting, the Viacoms of the world and some of these Chinese ADRs that trade in the U.S. markets, you didn't even really notice this happening. And I think part of that's the size of it. I mean, to hear about $30 billion in losses, being taken, that's a very large number to us. But the markets have grown exponentially in size, since the long-term capital management blow up in 1998. So, the simple fact is the value of the market overall has grown so much. A secondary thing would be that the banks, because of all the Wall Street bailouts they received and because of the tighter post-Great Financial Crisis regulation, a lot of the banks have are in better capitalized positions and have less leverage on their balance sheets than they did heading into the Great Financial Crisis. So you add it all together, the relative smaller size, and I can't believe I'm saying smaller, size of this fund to the markets than, say, long-term capital management might have been, plus the fact that the banks are in pretty good shape, plus I would throw a third thing in. People know, especially after what happened last year, that the Fed's not only, willing to buy treasury bonds or mortgage bonds, they're willing to buy corporate bonds, junk bonds, backstop the CLO markets, and on and on and on. So, which is both a benefit and a curse, right? It stops problems in the shorter term from people panicking because they know there's going to be a central bank backstop. But in the long term, it just continues to generate more of the moral hazard, which in turn means bigger and bigger, financial instability and financial crises are going to be coming down the pike. And that one last point I would make there, as an investor and Wall Street in general is focusing on the short to intermediate term implications of what's being done here. Longer term, this enormous amount of debt that's being piled on the economy, enormous deficits we're running up, even if Biden gets some of these tax hikes, the fact that a lot of this stuff spending is going to, go way above and beyond what kind of revenue those tax hikes are going to pull in, that leads us to real trouble down the road. But again, that's kind of maybe let's call it a 2024 worry or something like that. And Wall Street knows it's got some time to play with, to make hay while the sun shines.
Yeah, that's really been the story, though, over this last decade is just, I guess, kicking the can down the road. But I know there's a lot of bears saying it can't keep on continuing, but it has kept on continuing, which is, I think, very fascinating.
You know, I look back, a good analog to, you know, is what happened in the early to mid 2000s. I mean, I saw what was going on in the housing market here. I saw what was going on in the mortgage market in my own backyard, that, you know, local developers raising prices 5% a week, and, you know, people taking on all these idiotic mortgages with no money down, no job, no income, no, you know, all that stuff. But, you know, you could start seeing that stuff happen in 2003, 2004, but the market didn't, the housing market didn't start bursting until 2006, and the stock market didn't pop until 2007. So the important thing in all this, in my perspective, is timing. I know, you know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, that this kind of behavior is not going to be able to last forever. But you have, as an investor, you have to be tactical and also say, do I want to get in front of the freight train and get run over, or do I want to wait, you know, make some money now and then worry about switching sides when the time and the market conditions are appropriate to do so?
Mike, let's talk a little bit more about this infrastructure bill. Then you brought it up a couple of times. How critical is the infrastructure bill to, I guess, the overall health of the markets? It sounds pretty critical, but how do you see that trickling down into some of the commodities then?
Sure. I mean, you can already see, if you look at the last several weeks, you can already see a shift in market leadership from companies, large growth companies, large tech companies that tend to be priced on their ability to generate strong earnings growth, even in a lackluster economy. Money's rotating out of those kinds of names, and it's rotating into cyclicals, economically sensitive sectors, industrials, financials, you know, things tied to construction, industry, you know, consulting, architecture, engineering firms, those kinds of things. I think that's absolutely going to continue. I don't think we've seen, you know, the most of that or all of that move, because so much money had been piled up in those in favor sectors for many, many years. And the rotation only started, you know, last year, midway through, as we were coming out of the depths of the COVID crisis. So I think there's going to be some, you know, momentum and timing to that move. So I think you want to follow along with it, which is what I've been doing in the Safe Money Report. As far as, you know, what it means for base metals, commodities, things like that, you know, absolutely. Anything that's going to be benefiting from, you know, increased construction activity, road building, commercial activity, you know, all of those things that are going to be part of this, you know, you definitely do want to try and be giving yourself more exposure to that. And I would even say, you know, we've had a 6, 7, 8 month correction, tougher time, relatively speaking, for precious metals and those mining type companies. But I think if interest rates even stabilize and you throw on top of that the turbocharge impact of all this spending and what it means for, you know, sort of money printing and so on, I think that those sectors are now in the process of basing. You've seen some encouraging action in the last couple of weeks in precious metals themselves and the mining shares. And I think you might be on the cusp of a new leg up there. So I think I'm probably, you know, I've always liked the sector even through this correction. I think I'm probably more bullish now than I've been in many, many months on metals, precious metals as well.
Okay, let's quickly talk about precious metals, and we will quickly get into base metals a little bit more detail. But precious metals, you're right, especially gold, much more constructive, let's say, end to March with the way that the gold price traded and also the miners traded. What's your assessment of that over 7 month long correction? Everyone was calling for a correction, but the length of it, I think, caught some people off guard.
Yeah, I think it's really all goes back to interest rates, in my opinion. I mean, you know, you get a rising treasury yield that's steadily heading higher, and you get some money that flows out of gold because gold yields 0% and treasuries went from yielding, you know, on the 10-year, 70-ish, 80 basis points up to about, what, you know, as much as 150, 160. You see that happen, you're going to see some money come out. But again, all you need is a stabilization in interest rates, or sort of a shift in the curve where, you know, you see short-term rates tend to go up more, but long-term rates not go up as much or even start going down. That's going to flatten the yield curve, and that's going to bring money back into the metals, which is what we're already seeing. So again, I think that you're right. It probably did last longer than even I was expecting. But like I said, I'm more constructive, more encouraged now than I've been in quite some time. You know, again, speaking from a tactical standpoint, long-term, nothing shifted. I've believed in the bull market in precious metals since, you know, the back half of 2018. And I still think we're probably only in the fifth or sixth inning of this move overall.
Okay. Yeah, that's encouraging. I know, just some of the gold bugs, they are pretty devastated by that correction. But still, remember, we're over 1700 for gold. That's still a very strong price compared to where it was. And I think it's noteworthy hearing from a lot of generalists that gold is still on their radar. It's not hated. It's just the rest of the market is mostly distracted and seeing gains in other sectors. But gold, if it can start an uptrend, I have no doubt that more of the generalists will hop back in. When it comes to copper, though, copper trading around $4 a pound, when you take into account where copper was after that March washout, copper's more than doubled in price. And for a base metal like copper, and one that a lot of people use as a barometer for the economy, that's a really aggressive move. So how do you see copper moving? Again, taking into account the infrastructure bill, but also considering the copper was very close to all-time highs just about a month and a half ago.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's been a heck of a run already. You know, a lot of stimulus and sort of economic rebound, impact has already been priced in. But, you know, again, just like gold, maybe with less of a time frame, I think you get through this correction and you still sort of evaluate, you know, what are we looking at in terms of economic growth worldwide? What are we looking at in terms of continued stimulus? I mean, the Biden administration is talking about wave after wave of this. Other foreign economies are talking about the same kind of thing, if not on the same scale as what Biden's doing. So, you look at all of that and you look at some of the different industries that use copper and some of the spending that's going to be directed towards those industries. And I think that overall, longer term, I mean, the outlook still is bullish there. Again, you know, short term impact, sure, you could see this correction go for a little while, but I certainly wouldn't be shorting or be aggressively jumping out of base metals plays, just given what's going to be going on in terms of the magnitude and the duration of this stimulus spending.
Yeah, fair enough. Mike, how do you play the copper market? If you were to invest in copper, would you invest in an ETF? Would you go down into some of the larger miners? How would you play that?
Just like with precious metals, my outlook, generally speaking, for the Safe Money Report and so on, is you want to, I mean, it depends a lot on how much money you have to invest. If you don't have a lot of money, you start, for example, in gold and silver, you start with gold and silver ETFs. There's plenty of them that trade in Canada and the U.S. If you want to, if you have additional money, you can, you know, use some of the larger ETFs that track the sector. But then it always, in my opinion, makes sense to, if you are able to and want to do the work and have and so on, to drill down, sorry about the pun, into some of these smaller and even for your speculative money, very small type companies. It's not for 100% of your money, but you do honestly, as you're in a longer term bull market, there's some of these very large profit opportunities that, if you have the money available, go down the smaller spectrum, have a few sort of, small cap type names in there. But that's if you have the time and the money to step down. There's nothing wrong with starting with ETFs, both share ETFs and underlying metal ETFs. But I think that the larger your portfolio is, the more percentage wise you want to be putting in actual physical metal or mid cap and small cap miners as well.
Okay. Well, Mike, I've been bringing on a lot of different companies in the gold and copper space trying to at least share some of their stories and help our audience make some of the decisions when they do drive down into some of those stocks, because it can be tough and it can also be a big world out there trying to get a handle on what these stocks are doing and what makes them more valuable than the other large group of them. Mike, it's great chatting with you. Thank you very much for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we'll chat again in another couple weeks. Thanks, Mike.
Sounds good.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.